Welcome to A Real Affliction, BPD Culture and Stigma, a podcast devoted to exploring how we experience, treat, write about, and conceptualize borderline personality disorder. My name is Cynthia Gralla. I'm a writer and teacher with a history of BPD. Trigger warning, this episode will mention suicide attempts. In 1943, French philosopher and mystic Simone Weil wrote an essay called Human Personality, in which she argued that the impersonal quality of goodness in each human being, not the individual themselves, is sacred. She recognized an afflicted class of people whom the privileged speak about glibly, using words like rights and personality. These people, she wrote, are denied true words to comprehend their own suffering. She urged readers to help the afflicted find words of impersonal goodness, writing, "A stag advancing voluntarily step by step to offer itself to the teeth of a pack of hounds is about as probable as an act of attention directed towards a real affliction which is close at hand on the part of a mind which is free to avoid it." I took the name of this podcast from that sentence. Although they align the afflicted with the socioeconomic class of people, her advice to approach and listen to people in pain sums up my mission here too. Through this podcast, I want to encourage people to pay more attention to those of us who suffer from borderline personality disorder, or BPD. I want them to forget what they think they know about us and listen to how we feel and how we view the world. With my guests, I want to find meaningful words in order to demystify the disorder, reduce stigma, and think about how culture reflects and influences mental illness in forms like literature, fairy tales, film, and photography. I'll also talk with my guest about common co-occurring conditions and experiences, including substance use disorder, complex PTSD, eating disorders, and child sexual abuse. We'll examine BPD and stigma through the lenses of medical history, feminist and disability studies, and bioethics. The word stigma derives from the Latin word for mark or brand and the Greek word for tattoo, and it refers to either an unfairly negative set of beliefs or a wound. From the second definition, we get the word stigmata, meaning a set of miraculous wounds that mimic those seen on the body of Jesus Christ during crucifixion. Saint Francis of Assisi is renowned as the first person to receive the stigmata, but he was followed by a host of women, possibly starting with Saint Catherine of Siena, the first female doctor of the church in the 14th century. She kept her wounds hidden until her death, one of countless women from that time through today to try to hide her afflictions. Saint Catherine was not the only nun to conceal her stigmata. Others did too, probably out of fear of making their convent notorious. Medieval scholar Caroline Walker Bynum points out that during this period, female saints, especially those gifted stigmata, were the mirror image of society's notion of the witch. Both had marks on their bodies from incubi or God. Both were thought to be possessed by visions. Women like Saint Catherine had to take care not to be confused with witches, lest they be burned at the stake for the crime of holiness. Roughly 9 out of 10 stigmata bearers were women, and contemporary scholars have conducted a kind of pathological witch hunt, retroactively diagnosing them with an array of stigmatized mental health problems, including dissociative identity disorder and anorexia. By the late 19th century, the stigmata was often granted not by God, but by doctors. Photographers of the time documented women being treated for hysteria at a Parisian hospital for madwomen and prostitutes, housed in a former gunpowder factory, which has been called the Versailles of pain, a nightmare, or quite simply, hell, by historians. In one photograph, a patient named Augustine, who often performed her hysteria before crowds of the wealthy and the curious, stretches out in a pose of crucifixion, suspended between her present hell and the hope for a cure. Her doctor, Jean-Martin Charcot, a neurologist and early mentor to Freud who taught at the hospital, encouraged these poses, which reenacted paintings of Jesus Christ and the saints. Charcot didn't see hysterics such as Augustine as devil spawn, but the diagnosis itself stigmatized women simply for being women. The word hysteria comes from the Greek word for womb and from an assumption dating back to 1900 BC that only women were prone to it due to their uterus. Some contemporary scholars have noted the parallels between how women with hysteria and people with BPD have been perceived by their respective eras and cultures. I'll return to the idea of these past women who were both figuratively and literally stigmatized throughout this podcast. When health-related stigma occurs, the tattoo signifying our condition, usually in the form of a diagnosis or behaviors that match one, is often all that others see of us. I know this because I've had many diagnoses over the years: anorexia, major depression with anxiety, substance use disorder, PTSD, systemic lupus, endometriosis, and BPD. But the last one was my scarlet letter diagnosis. According to researcher and advocate Sarah Maslin, the diagnosis of BPD has been heavily stigmatized, meaning that it has come to serve as a marker of socially undesirable traits or behaviors. Maslin explains that the stigma stretches back almost 100 years. It was first coined in the 1930s and then was used pejoratively to label patients, mostly women, whom clinicians believed were untreatable, difficult, or problematic. Research shows that stigma against BPD originates within the medical community. One peer-reviewed study found mental health professionals were likely to describe patients with BPD as difficult, treatment-resistant, manipulative, demanding, immoral, attention-seeking, and unworthy of care. A 2017 study confirmed these biases and added the terms freak, hysterical, and weird. My current therapist doesn't even want to tell me exactly what her supervisors said to her about BPD during her training. She is one of the good ones who didn't let this distorted view affect her relationship with clients with BPD, but many clinicians do. As a result, a lot of us with BPD suffer not only from outside stigma, but from self-stigma too. Self-mutilation and repeated suicide attempts, which are hallmarks of BPD, are particularly inexplicable to therapists, psychiatrists, and nurses. I understand that self-destruction can seem counterintuitive and almost perverse. But psychotherapist Ellis Amder explained that self-mutilation is a language and repeated something his mentor, the late archetypal psychologist James Hillman, used to say: wounds are also a kind of mouth and they speak with their own voice. For many people with BPD, cutting amounts to stress reduction because it releases endorphins. In a double-blind study in which Narcan was given to one group of habitual cutters and a placebo to another, the Narcan group complained about their terrible pain when they self-harmed as usual. The opiates hadn't flowed as they were meant to. And suicide attempts by people with BPD, while scorned by some bystanders as attention-seeking, are sincerely undertaken in an effort to halt relentless emotions and racing thoughts. Around 70% of those diagnosed with BPD attempt suicide at least once, and about 10% of people with the disorder die by suicide, 50 times the general population's rate. For those with severe BPD, that figure quadruples. Outcomes are also worsened by concurrent substance abuse, which is found in around half of people with BPD. When we suffer sexual abuse, the risk of death by suicide is nearly 1,000 times that of the general population. The suicide rate is not hard to understand if you Google worst pain. You'll be inundated by articles with titles like "The Most Painful of All Disorders, Borderline Personality Disorder." Overall, BPD clips an average of 20 years off those affected due to suicide, and our susceptibility to heart attacks and chronic illnesses like autoimmune disorders, worse outcomes in cancer treatment, and collateral damage from substance abuse and/or malnutrition. Yet despite all of these impacts on mortality, BPD receives 1/10 of the funding designated for bipolar disorder, a mental illness with similar prevalence. BPD affects millions. So why does it receive so little funding? That's one question I want us to consider throughout this podcast. Today, the BPD diagnosis is still assigned to mostly women. 3 cisgender women are diagnosed with it for every 1 cisgender man. And in the very limited research that has been conducted so far on trans, queer, and non-binary people with BPD, their population seems to be diagnosed with it at higher rates than cisgender men as well. Men may be as susceptible to it, but BPD is stereotyped as a woman's disorder, and the most egregious media portrayals of it, including Fatal Attraction, have only amplified and toxified this stereotype. The stigma against BPD didn't just wound me. It almost killed me. The psychiatrist I worked with in my late 20s and early 30s outright refused to give me the diagnosis, concerned about how other clinicians, from my GP to inpatient psychiatrist, would perceive me. So she just went on pretending that I had depression and anxiety and prescribing me drugs, although drug therapy isn't effective for many people with BPD. And even without its brand on my medical chart, I could hardly find therapists willing to work with me. At the end of my initial consultation session, after hearing about my frequent suicide attempts and the psych ward holds that resulted, they would suddenly remember that they didn't have time to take on a new patient, which may have been true. My wounds multiplied. I would have likely died from several overdoses that I intended to kill me, but I'd become a drug addict as a coping mechanism and thereby developed a ridiculously high drug tolerance. One time, as I was blacking out from barbiturates, I remembered how as a child I'd owned a dollhouse with a hinged roof and once opened it up, looked down, and thought, "That's all that's within. It looks so much bigger from the inside." And in that instant, I saw my tiny self, my childhood self. I saw my fragility, and I wanted to cradle myself in my arms. But for decades, that was the only time I could feel any love for myself, when I was close to death. But here's the thing. My suicide attempts could have been avoided. No one else with BPD needs to die due to suicide either. What we need is universal access to proper treatment and cultural acceptance. Many, many people are in functional recovery from BPD, including me now, no longer meeting most or any criteria for it after being helped by a variety of techniques, which include dialectical behavior therapy, schema therapy, transference focus therapy, EMDR therapy, and mindfulness. We just need clinicians, family members, educators, and community members willing to look past the stigma and support from governments for the more expensive treatment programs. Like many people with BPD, I entered a calmer phase around the time I turned 40. I was weaned off my daily pile of psychotropic meds and settled into my career and second marriage. While I was diagnosed with lupus and endometriosis during this period, I remained stable and grateful for having survived BPD. However, 2.5 years ago, I underwent surgery to remove an ovary that contained 2 endometrial cysts, one intact and one already ruptured. As I recovered, I gradually realized that I'd been catapulted into perimenopause. I was soaked by night sweats and periods that lasted most of the month. My moods ricocheted between euphoria and despair like they had during early adulthood. Insomnia ruined my sleep. I was depressed, emotionally reactive, and prone to anger, recklessness, and suicidal thoughts. I tried to research the connection between a tough perimenopause and a history of BPD, because it seemed like I was embodying some of the latter's criteria again. But as of this recording, in April 2024, there are no peer-reviewed studies dedicated to the interaction between BPD and menopause. One study mentioned in passing that BPD features tend to be greatest during adolescence and perimenopause because of the variation in hormones, and a 2017 longitudinal study that tracked women with BPD over 25 to 50 years noted in passing heightened mood volatility in the lead up to menopause. This glaring oversight in the research is dangerous given that both BPD and perimenopause can cause destructive mood dysregulation and suicide attempts. In fact, among American women as a whole, the suicide rate is highest for those aged 45 to 64, mostly, it seems, due to menopause and its transition. My rheumatologist sympathized with me, saying, "You've fallen into the research black hole with two conditions that mostly or only affect women." And this omission is one of the reasons I committed to writing a book about BPD and starting a podcast devoted to it. Still, I had moments of fear and doubt about sharing my story of BPD. Countering stigma requires also encountering stigma. In July of last year, my literary agent sent me a New York Times article about an ultramarathon runner with BPD. The runner and his wife talk about coping with his disorder, including episodes of explosive rage that have led him to hit her. For some reason, I decided to read the comments section. And as I expected, I absorbed the hatred and prejudice there, including someone who identified as a mental health professional saying that even she and her colleagues run from BPD. I'd seen these types of comments many times before, but on that day, they crushed me. But after my husband convinced me to sleep on it, I woke and reminded myself that I had a choice. I could let the stigma silence me, or I could try to fight it by sharing my mental health history. What would people think of me if I shared it? I didn't know, and I don't know. But I'd rather worry about what people would think of me if I didn't share my story when sharing it might help someone. And I am not alone. Many who suffer from BPD are podcasting, writing books, and giving talks. Because people with BPD are compassionate. We feel so much and understand how badly feeling can feel. There are some very good BPD podcasts out there already, including BPD, Gaining a Wiser Mind, From Borderline to Beautiful, The BPD Bunch, and Breaking the Borderline and Sensitivity Stigma. The existing podcasts are usually produced by one or multiple people who have lived experience with BPD or by someone who treats it. I felt like what I could add to the mix was an interview format podcast backed by my personal experience of BPD and research based on my work as a writer and professor. I have a doctorate in comparative literature from the University of California, Berkeley, so I will be drawing on literature, film, television, art, philosophy, psychology, history, and peer-reviewed studies as I listen to my guests' perspectives. I will be highlighting hope, healing, newer treatments, and healthy coping mechanisms. However, I'm not what my mother-in-law calls a real doctor, so please bear in mind that I can't replace guidance or a treatment plan from your own real medical doctors. Most of all, I will be asking questions of my guests and about what's going on in the culture that frames BPD. In her Pulitzer Prize-winning memoir, The Undying, Ann Boyer writes, "As soon as a patient lies down on the exam table, she has laid down her life on a bed of narrowed answers, but the questions are never sufficiently clear." She wrote that in the context of breast cancer, but I believe this narrowing often occurs when people are diagnosed with BPD too. I don't have many answers, yet I'd like for these episodes to at least clarify the questions and broaden the possibilities. In the first year of this podcast, I'll be interviewing people who have experienced, written about, advocated for, conceptualized, and treated BPD. I'll converse with co-founders of Emotions Matter and the BPD Society of British Columbia, two nonprofits that offer BPD resources, including online peer support groups. Professor Sarah Maslin, one of the leading researchers on BPD and how stigma against it complicates care, will overview the history of the diagnosis and imagine the future of BPD care. Jesse Shepherd, a licensed therapist and author of the wonderful Millie the Cat Has Borderline Personality Disorder, will share her thoughts on how children's books and non-stigmatizing language can support people with BPD and their loved ones. Psychotherapist Ellis Amder will chat with me about his success using Badawan Jin Qigong, a Chinese movement and breathing system, as a supplemental treatment for BPD. American McGee, the celebrated video game designer and creator of the BPD Rabbit by Plushy Dreadfuls, will talk about trauma, fairy tales, and when metaphors become stereotype. In a two-part solo episode, I'll read excerpts from posthumously published diaries by two women with BPD as I consider the therapeutic power of writing. And a conversation with Nina Shope, the author of Asylum, a gorgeous historical novel about 19th century treatments for hysteria, will show how the history of medicine may illuminate our understanding of BPD today. Other upcoming episodes will focus on intergenerational trauma, bioethics, and the field of eco-psychology, which considers the intersection of nature and mental health. I'll also hear from Courtney Stallings, author of Laura's Ghost, Women Speak Out About Twin Peaks, about how the character of Laura Palmer has become a lodestar for victims of child sexual abuse and complex PTSD, both of which are common in people with BPD. Please follow A Real Affliction, BPD, Culture, and Stigma, so that you don't miss any upcoming episodes. I'll be posting two each month. I really hope you'll come back in May, which is designated as both BPD Awareness Month and Mental Health Awareness Month, for a conversation with Bailey McKnight of the BPD Society of British Columbia, and the first part of my chat with Jesse Shepherd, author of Millie the Cat Has Borderline Personality Disorder. If you have experience or expertise that would fit the podcast's focus and would like to be interviewed, please feel free to reach out to me at cynthiagrallabooks@gmail.com. Have a great day, take good care of yourself, and thank you so much for listening. I'd like to thank Rebecca Gagan for sharing her expertise, Owen Johnson for creating the podcast cover and taking its photo, Mark Spada for helping me choose the music, and Misha Wolf for encouraging me to pursue this project. If you are having thoughts of suicide, please call or text 988 to reach the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, or go to speakingofsuicide.com/resources. The articles and books mentioned in this episode are listed in the episode notes.